This is a YUN interview with Ambassador Lavrov in New York City on April 18th, 2001. The interviewer is Sutherland. Ambassador Lavrov, I would like first of all to thank you very much for agreeing to participate in this Yale University Oral History Project, which pertains to the United Nations in general, but in particular at this point to the operation of the UN Special Commission, which dealt with the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And my first question really is, when did you first become directly involved as ambassador in New York with the operation and, for that matter, with the counterterrorism related to UNSCOM?
Well, I came here in September 1994, and shortly after that there was another crisis in Iraqi question in the Security Council. It was not directly related to UNSCOM. It was about Iraqi troops moving towards Kuwait in the fall of 1994, and at that time Russian Foreign Minister Kozyrev undertook an emergency trip to Kuwait and Baghdad, and his visit helped to produce Iraqi government statement asserting the respect of sovereignty and territorial integrity of Kuwait. That was the first crisis which I encountered personally here in New York. But as far as UNSCOM is concerned, I believe it was the same year, 1994, because UNSCOM was producing bi-monthly reports to the Security Council, and I'm sure that there was one before the end of 1994, and it was Ambassador Kells, who was later moved by his government to another position, and Ambassador Butler was appointed to head UNSCOM. Actually, under Ambassador Kells, and before the famous chicken farm episode, UNSCOM reporting to the Security Council was not a cause of much controversy. UNSCOM, on the basis of information which they had at that time, was presenting a picture of progress in closing down the files. And IAEA, which was headed by Ambassador Blix at that time, was reporting the most encouraging news. And basically, as of 1996, I think, IAEA part of the job was broadly considered as basically finished. There were two or three questions which IAEA still had, but they related not to material balance of the nuclear program of Iraq, and it is material balance, I want to stress, which is described as an obligation of Iraq to eliminate any material things related to the weapons of mass destruction problems. It is material balance which is important from the point of view of 687 resolution. But IAEA, as of 1996, I believe, was broadly satisfied that on the material side there was nothing left. They were quite successful in identifying and destroying the prescribed problems in the nuclear field in Iraq, and the questions they had at that time basically related to history of the Iraqi problem. A committee which was formed and which was currently overseeing the Iraqi nuclear program. The exchange of letters between some foreign company and Iraq, and I had a question whether the offer which Iraq received from a foreign supply was solicited or not. You know, this sort of things, but as far as material balance is concerned, IAEA was basically reporting to the Security Council the absence of any evidence that Iraq still has some prescribed nuclear programs. And as I said, ANSCOM was also moving ahead, in particular on the missiles, and on chemical and biological weapons as well. But then the defection of Mr. Kamel Hassan,
Hussein,
and his revelations, of course, gave rise to new suspicions and the huge amount of material which was discovered at the chicken farm had to be translated, studied, analyzed, and this gave ANSCOM a new reason for reanalyzing and rethinking their previous conclusions. But that was basically the... In 1994, when I came here, the picture was much more optimistic than later.
Right, and I think it was at that time that Ambassador Hayes had submitted a relatively positive report to the Security Council in response to considerable pressure from Iran. In that connection, were you satisfied with the amount of information that Ambassador Hayes and Oscom were providing in there? Actually, they had submitted reports every 6 months.
The 6 month reports, which were called comprehensive reports.
Right.
But bi-monthly, they were also reporting on some aspects of the activities.
And I think he kept in close touch with you and other ambassadors, especially the P5.
Absolutely. Any ambassador of the P5 and any ambassador of the Security Council member state were welcome to ANSCOM, and Mr. Karras and Mr. Karras was meeting with us regularly, either on our request or on his own initiative, whenever he needed some expertise to be given to ANSCOM, and we tried to be helpful. Well, I think that the amount of information provided did not cause much questions, as long as ANSCOM was basically saying that we are making progress, we are satisfied with Iraqi's cooperation, we are moving closer to the time when we would announce that all files have been closed. And when you have this type of reporting, you really don't want to ask too many questions, because you believe that the professionals who do their job, they would know when to raise concern. But I would say that it was after Ambassador Kiel's left that quite a number of members of the Security Council, namely Russia, China, France, Malaysia when it was on the council, Egypt when it was on the council, began to be much more interested in getting more details as to how ANSCOM is conducting its work.
Right. In that connection, I'd like to revert to sanctions and the attitude of the Iraqis. I wonder, first of all, to what extent did the Iraqis seek to maintain contact with you and with the Russian side during these years?
Well, the contacts with Iraqis have been regular. And both on the initiative and on our initiative, we have been always conveying to them our conviction that it's only through full cooperation with the Security Council and UNSCOM that they can achieve lifting of sanctions eventually. They have been conveying to us their concerns with some parts of UNSCOM operations. At the initial stage of my posting here, those concerns were not very numerous. They were basically satisfied, I think, with how Ambassador Keros was handling his file and the efforts like he undertook, I think, in June 1996, when he concluded understandings with them on how they should approach sovereign sites and how the dignity and sovereignty and integrity of Iraq should be respected. And he tried to agree a paper with them which would basically translate into practical terms of UNSCOM operations, those very abstract notions of international law. It was late, I think, it was... Well, there were still some complaints on the part of Iraq and the Keros, but they became more and more critical of UNSCOM when Ambassador Butler became chairman. And basically, they were challenging his concept that the onus is on Iraq, and that UNSCOM doesn't have to present any information they had to Iraqis for verification. But UNSCOM just can say, you must give us your account on biological program, or your account of chemical program, or missiles, for that matter. And then UNSCOM would read this account, would compare it with its own confidential information, and then it would just tell the Iraqis, no, this is wrong. This is not true, what you are giving us. Go back, do your homework again, because we know something which you don't know. I mean, which you don't know, we know. And what we know does not correlate with what you are giving us. And the Iraqis were saying that we are sorry, but what we gave you is everything we have. So please, if you have any suspicions, tell us in what area you have your suspicions, and we would try to remove this misunderstanding or this suspicion. And Butler was saying, no, 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 if I tell you about my suspicions, you would know where I get my information from, and you might then tailor your answer in a way which would, you know, still hide the truth. And this, and that's how and that's when Ambassador Butler introduced in UNSCOM a new operation, a new division, I think, in UNSCOM headquarters, which was dealing with concealment.
Yes.
But we have been trying in our regular contacts with Ambassador Butler, with whom I was very close during his time as Ambassador of Australia, and kept these good relations when he became a chairman of UNSCOM. We have been trying to, not to impose on him, but to explain to him that some of the Iraqis' concerns on procedures were legitimate. And even from the point of view of the Security Council, if UNSCOM tells Iraq, no, what you gave us is a lie, well, in more diplomatic terms, and Iraq would say, we are sorry, but that's what we have. We don't have any other evidence of what was going on, and that's all we have. And then if UNSCOM just says, no, this is not what we want from you, then we are deadlocked. So we were encouraging him to find ways to indicate to Iraqis that, I mean, without disclosing the sources of his information, to tell them that, look, but what you gave me is not complete, because you should also look into these and these areas of your biological or your chemical file. And he was categorically against it. But then my point is that even in the court of law, I mean, you have to prove that the guy is guilty. Of course, Security Council Chapter 7 resolutions are not something to be entirely compatible with the legal procedures in the normal court. But from the practical point of view, this was certainly a way nowhere. I think there were two specific cases when we really were very concerned that Anscombe was reporting to the council full or total lack of Iraqis cooperation, and the critical mess of confrontation was concentrating with the Security Council, and the US and UK were demanding some tough action. And on two very specific, and at that time we started to be much more specific as far as Anscombe presentations were concerned. Until then, Anscombe would just say, well, we asked Iraqis about something, they told us this is not true. I mean, they told us something, we considered it, and this something was absolutely not true. So we demanded from them another reply. And then when this type of reporting was used to ignite information in the council, we together with China, France, and Egypt at that time, then Malaysia, and some other non-aligned countries, we started to press Anscombe to be more specific in explaining to us what was it all about. And then, as we proceeded in that way, there were a couple of cases. One of them I remember, Anscombe said at some point, okay, we will tell you what it is about. We have a picture of a biological bomb, and we have been, on the basis of this picture, which we didn't show to the Iraqis, we have been pressing them to accept that they did have this type of biological bomb developed.
Right.
And the Iraqis were rejecting any accusations of that sort. And then when we pressed Anscombe and said, look, but you really have, this is serious, biological bomb is a serious matter, you really have to make sure that, you know, Iraqis don't have it, and for this you have to present your evidence. And when they did eventually present this evidence at a seminar in Germany, I think,
right,
I don't remember the date, Iraqis said, fine, we have to send it to Baghdad for comments. They sent it to Baghdad, and next morning they received a reply saying, yes, we have this bomb, but this is a chemical bomb. But because of the quality of the picture, which was taken from a videotape, probably, a special marking was not visible, and that had this marking been visible, it would be immediately understood that this was not a biological bomb, but a chemical bomb, and this particular chemical bomb had been accounted by a chemical inspection by Anscombe 6 months earlier. Well, which also touches upon the problem of very high compartmentalization of Anscombe's activities at that time, maybe for good reason, because of the need to keep confidentiality of information which they were acting. But in that particular instance, it was accepted by Anscombe that they were wrong. So, just on this example alone, I spent quite some time with Richard Butler saying, look, if you know, now we understand that mistakes could happen, and that because of the quality of pictures or whatever, you can be misled in your suspicions. And if you keep everything confidential without, you know, trying to give information which would help clarify situations like this, you may be having your suspicions forever, and maybe for no good reason. So it was then that we started to really Askan and Scone without compromising the sources of information to find ways to share with the Council their suspicions in more specific terms and to share with Iraqis, at least to give them hints of what problems Anscombe still had. He accepted this approach reluctantly, but it was not applied consistently.
And I think that was when he introduced a little later this idea of seminars where the two sides met together.
Well, actually, this episode relates to one of the first seminars of that sort. And I'm not saying that Iraqis were always cooperative. And we were asked by Anscombe privately in our contacts and when Baku visited Moscow to help influence the Iraqis to be more forthcoming. But by that time, more and more problems accumulated on Anscombe's part. More and more evidence of Anscombe's bias, I would say, were accumulated. And the Iraqis were very, jumpy about this, and they didn't like this Anscombe trend. So whenever we would be making a point, which is part of our position of principle, that they should fully cooperate, etc., etc., they would present us with their reading of the facts, accusing Anscombe of being biased. And in quite a number of cases, we didn't have any arguments to deny those accusations. So it was becoming more and more difficult to persuade the Iraqis to cooperate with a body which was not proving itself in our eyes as an objective body.
What did you think was the principal Iraqi motivation? Were they, in your impression, primarily interested in getting rid of the sanctions or getting rid of Anscombe? Were the sanctions the major objective of Saddam Hussein's issue?
Well, I wouldn't be able to answer this question because I cannot read other people's minds. I do think that Iraq was, still is, should be interested in lifting sanctions. And I do think that many factors played a role in creating the crisis which blew up the entire situation in December 1998, was it? And one of the first mistakes by the Council was, I think it happened in July 1996, when El Baradei already was IAEA Director General, and he presented a report to the Council in response to a presidential statement which we managed to agree by consensus in May, same year. I think I'm correct about the dates, which is not easy, by the way. And that presidential statement basically said that, having received IAEA previous report, and having considered that, as far as material balance is concerned, nuclear fire is not presenting any danger, but that IAEA still had two or three questions, or five questions at that time, which, as I said, related not to material balance, but to history. Encouraged IAEA and Iraq to continue discussing those questions and asking IAEA to report on the outcome of those discussions in July 1996, which IAEA did. And the report basically said that they still have these questions, so some of them are still relevant, but at the same time, he clearly stated in the report that the ongoing monitoring system for nuclear sites in Iraq is functioning, and that these questions can be handled in the context of the ongoing monitoring system. And 687 and the subsequent resolutions clearly mean that as soon as you shift the disarmament files into phase of ongoing monitoring, that's the cutoff date for declaring that this particular file has been closed. And we, together with the French and the Chinese, Egypt at that time, some others, suggested that the Council should adopt a very simple resolution saying we receive this report, we take note that as of today, nuclear file has been shifted into ongoing monitoring phase, in the context of which the remaining issues would be clarified. This would not have any effect on sanctions.
No, because it's only one part.
Yes, it's only one of the four files. Mm-hmm. But this would have been a political signal to Iran. You move in this direction, you cooperate in the same vein with ANSCOM and all three remaining files, you would get it. And then this resolution, which, as I said, had only political meaning and no practical outcome, no practical potential, was blocked, basically by the US and UK. And this was the beginning, I think, of Iraqis rethinking of the entire situation, and that's when they understood for themselves, they decided for themselves, I think, that whatever they do, as long as Saddam Hussein is in power in Baghdad, they're not going to get it. And of course, since then, they have been strengthened in this conviction by the policies of the United States, which had and the previous administration, you know, started the special program to support the opposition and to special court to try Saddam Hussein was discussed in last year in Washington, and this is the policy of the new administration as well. But, and Iraqis do believe, though there is still a review of U.S. policy on Iraq going on, but they do believe that whatever they do, I mean, what is what they their logic is, how, why should they cooperate with the U.N. while they know for sure, they're convinced that as long as this current government is in Baghdad, in power in Baghdad, they would not get any lifting of or even a suspension.
Yes, and you identify that just in the way of background. Mr. Dolfer, who was the...
just saw him today.
He just saw him today.
He was in Europe.
He has said almost identical thing. He identified the date later.
A bit later?
1998, where the Iraqis decided, well, this no longer point.
And of course, you know, we could discuss for a very long time the actual chain of events in 1998 when the Iraqis refused to continue dialogue with ANSCOM in August, and they severed all links with ANSCOM, and then there was a crisis and the threat of use of force by the U.S., and then last minute negotiations, and I was described by Butler in his articles as, you know, sitting with Nizar Hamdoun, Iraqi ambassador, and redrafting the letter which he was supposed to give to avoid the airstrikes. And this all was true. But the crisis which culminated in August when Tariq Aziz told Butler, I don't want to continue with ANSCOM. I'm not saying that this was the right thing to do. I was not there. And very much depends in this type of situations on atmospherics. And from this point of view, I can only testify that Richard Butler was not always diplomatic enough to remain within the framework of his position. The chairman of the United Nations Security Council subsidiary board as an international civil servant. So, and knowing Iraqis and knowing Arabs, knowing human beings, national pride and things like that, they shouldn't be the only criteria in handling the disarmament issues. But if you are in business of diplomacy, you certainly have to take this into account.
There were, from the Iraqis in particular, but also from one American, accusations that UNSCOM was being utilized by national governments for national intelligence purposes.
Well, it was in the media.
Yeah, of course it was in the media. And Scott Ritter made some very strong accusations. What was your attitude on that? Were you concerned? Russian side, did you feel there was validity, or did you feel that in fact every government was getting a little bit of information from Moscow?
Well, maybe all governments cooperating with UNSCOM were getting a bit of information. It was no secret that intelligence officers, special services officers were represented in UNSCOM.
They had to be.
And intelligence communities of different countries were providing information to UNSCOM. Yes, according to what I know and what is made public, most of this information was provided by the US, UK, but a lot was provided by France, and something was provided by Russia to UNSCOM of what we knew. By the way, what is available clearly indicates that if you take the bulk of Iraq's programs on weapons of mass destruction, the percentage of the Soviet Union contribution, if you really analyze it, it was meager compared to Western contribution to these countries. So it is not to say that that they are responsible or they are not responsible. It's not about this. But when people try to present the Soviet and then Russian position as trying to to preserve these linkages, this is wrong. Or trying to hide some information. The famous case when gyroscopes.
Gyroscopes,
which were found in the river, dropped from the bridge, right. Etc. Yes, they were of Soviet origin. But this doesn't mean that the Soviet Union supplied them to, now you find Soviet and Russian weapons in many places, but the roots of those weapons are known. They are produced licensed in many countries of the world. But I think that what happened in 1998, and you asked about this spying aspect. We deliberately made a point in the Security Council and in our public comments, be it in Moscow or New York, just to ignore this. Not because we believed that this was right, but because we believe that this would be shifting the focus from the real problem. And the real problem was that the crisis created in December 1998 was artificial. After that episode, when in August 1998, Iraqis said that they would not have any dealings with UNSCOM, and UNSCOM left, and the tension in the council was increased, and at some point, as you remember, was it November? I think November, yes. When Americans already threatened with airstrikes unless Iraq resumes cooperation. And there was this hectic negotiation over the weekend with Ambassador Hamdoun present in the quiet room next to the Security Council, and us, the French, the Chinese, talking to them and talking to Americans, to other members of the Security Council, trying to avoid the use of force. But on the condition of ANSCOM resuming its work. And eventually this letter was approved after two or three redraftings, and President Clinton decided to call off the operation, to use force, and ANSCOM came back, and it was agreed that by December 15, I think, ANSCOM should report whether Iraq has been fully cooperating.
Yes, that pertains to the presidential sites, I think. Right.
No, presidential sites were...
Came back later, but...
No, before that.
Before that?
Before that.
Before that.
Early in 1998.
Right.
Presidential sites came after Kofi Annan visited Baghdad in February 1998. And produced this memorandum of understanding.
Right.
On presidential sites. Yeah, then the delegation from the council, together with ANSCOM experts, visited Iraq and visited the presidential sites.
Right. It had come up before, actually.
It was early in the first half of 1998.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But then, Butler's this regular visit to Iraq ended in Iraq is refusing to continue the cooperation with ANSCOM, and then this standoff took place in November, and then it was diffused. ANSCOM came back, and it was given about 1 month to resume its monitoring and its inspections, and to report by the middle of December whether Iraq was fully cooperating. And the end of this period, at the end of this period, in this month or so, they made about 400 visits to various sites, and they encountered problems in, I think, 5 cases, some of which were really not Iraqi's fault. For example, the one of these cases, reported by ANSCOM as a proof of lack of full cooperation, related to this Iranian Guards opposition camp inside Iraq, which is guarded by Iranians, and there is also an chain of guards offered by Iraq, but internal protection is by Iranians themselves. Mm-hmm. So ANSCOM came to this site and said that they have suspicion that this site might contain some proscribed material. And the Iraqi guards said that Iraqis only have access to this protection zone, and that beyond that zone, it was Iranians who were guarding the site. And the Iraqis said, you can go through Iraqi cordon, but then you have to talk to the Iranian opposition leaders who run this site. And this was cited, and the Iranians didn't let them in. And this was cited as a proof that Iraq didn't fully cooperate. And there were a couple of instances like that. And Butler was presenting an interim report to the council at the end of November, saying that yes, in most cases there is cooperation, but there are signs that they're not fully cooperating. And he cited a couple of examples, including this two, and then we checked with Iraqis, we double-checked with our ambassador in Iraq, and then we told Butler, look, but you know, these cases, they have the explanation, and you cannot you cannot really expect that each and every visit would be smooth. And when you do have objective reasons, like the one in the Iranian camp, you really have to be objective. So he did get, and he basically agreed that yes, he would take this into account when presenting final report. Then he went to Moscow, very early December 1998. I think Primakov was still, was he still the minister, prime minister, I don't remember. Anyway, he met with Primakov, he met with Ivanov, and I was not there, I was in New York, but I read the reports and then I double-checked with Primakov. And he clearly said, Butler clearly said, and I read the cable, and Primakov said, look, we are not interfering with your business, but the responsibility which you have on your shoulders is tremendous. And we hope that your report would be objective. And Butler said clearly that this is our record of the conversation, that on the basis of what he had received from the crown, from his team on the crown, please don't worry, the report is going to be positive for Iran. They have been cooperating. And then he writes the report which says that Iraq was not fully cooperating. And of course, in brackets, I must say that whenever we write the phrase full cooperation, it's really cornering ourselves. There is no such thing as full cooperation anything.
Right.
I mean, there is such thing, but depending on interpretation. And if somebody wants to say that there is no full cooperation, you can always explain that any single misstep is a proof of the absence of full cooperation. So we also have to draw lessons for the future wording of resolutions. But anyway, he writes this report. And before this report gets to the council, CNN announces that American planes are airborne. And then we read in the papers, I mean, I have all these files, his interviews, the Australian press, testimonies of many people who were involved, and Scott Ritter's sources in Anscombe, because by that time he had left, I think. And if what they said is right, then, at the same time as Butler was telling Primakov in Moscow that according to his information he receives from the ground, the report is going to be positive for him, at the same time, he was telling Sandy Durbin that the report will be negative. And it is not challenged by anybody, including Butler himself, that 3 days before the report was out of the press, and on its way to the members of the Security Council, it was made available to Washington. It is not challenged by anyone. And that's why it so happened that before we read the report, the planes were airborne, and as all of us hectically asked, having received the direction, asked for an emergency meeting of the Council and consultation room, the bombing started. And the Anscombe personnel had been withdrawn, and the humanitarian personnel was not even warned. And so after that, our government made the assessment and made it public that the airstrikes, the use of force, have been provoked by Anscombe and by Butler personnel. And we stick to this assessment. And given that, it was really irrelevant to spin the spy topic in the Security Council, in the UN, and whenever, because this spy theme appeared early 1999. Mm-hmm. And I was always replying to the questions from the media that we do believe that this is irrelevant, and Anscombe is dead, and Anscombe signed its own death sentence. Anscombe did withdraw itself on its own. It was not expelled from Iraq like it was in August 1999, but then it was allowed back. But the last truth about Anscombe's presence in Iraq, that this presence ended, not because Anscombe was expelled, but because Anscombe fled Iraq having produced a pretext for bombing.
You know, Mr. Ambassador, this question was not on my list, but I'm very impressed with how well you are acquainted with this file. And I just would like to ask, this was considered a very important topic from your perspective and from Moscow.
Yes.
Why?
Well, I've been asked many times